Welcome back to Booze and Buffy, a podcast where we are watching and discussing every episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel the series one by one. There will be no spoilers for future episodes, but we will be discussing details from this and previous episodes. Writing Doogie Howser fanfiction, I'm Harrison.
And I'm Jason, and I'm glad that I didn't stay the night in a child-sized coffin. Harrison, what episode are we watching this week?
Oh, we are watching Buffy Season 7, Episode 4, Help. This is the one where a conspicuously named girl, Cassie, comes to Buffy and tells her that she is going to die the following Friday. While this is initially interpreted as a threat of suicide, it's initially eventually revealed that it is more of a psychic vision, and Buffy does everything in her power to prevent Cassie's seemingly inevitable death.
And Help was written by Rebecca Rand Kirshner and was directed by my favorite name, Rick Rosenthal! And it originally aired on October 15th, 2002.
Jason.
Harrison.
Hi.
Yo.
How are you?
Pretty good. You?
Yeah, I've had...
I know. You've had a bit of a rough patch.
So, listeners, this episode's coming to you a little late, because last week, John and I were in a car accident. We're fine. I got some minor injuries, was pretty banged up. My right arm was all cut up like horror movie stuff. But as you can see, it is healing quite nicely.
Yeah.
This is a lot better than it. I'm down to one bandage.
There you go.
But, yeah, that sucked. Still a little sore, but, you know, otherwise we're okay. But now we're, you know, doing the insurance thing and everyone being like, get a lawyer. And I'm like, well, let's see what the insurance comes through with first before we get litigious. Luckily though, I have several cousins, and a sister-in-law, and lots of friends who are lawyers. So like, if it comes down to it, we can make that happen, but I would really prefer not to have to go through all that.
Yeah.
I would really just like the insurance company to just give us the money without us having to fight for it. Which I know is not how it works, but...
Yeah. Man, that's a little bit of a bummer. Good thing we got this uplifting episode just going.
Okay. No, like, I called Jason. We were going to record last Sunday, and I called Jason, like, from the emergency room. It was like, hey. In the middle of the movie night he was having, by the way. And I was like, can't talk long. I'm in between visits from doctors. But... can't record tomorrow.
It's like, let me start off by saying we're okay, and which I'm is like, oh my god.
And then, like, that is the thing. It's like you always start those conversations with, first of all, we're fine, but that still sets up the conversation in like a.
Although, after you told me that there was a car accident, I was like, I did like, okay, he said they're fine.
Yeah.
Level tone. You can do this, Big Stein.
No,
I'm very glad that you're both okay.
Thank you, thank you.
If I hadn't said it already.
No. I do want to take this time, though, just to do a little PSA for people, because this is something that I learned. So, if you... And I don't know if this is true for all phones, but I have an iPhone 15. But sometime last year, I noticed when I was going through my... I was editing a contact. I noticed that there was a spot where you can make a contact, an emergency contact, in your phone. I was like, that seems like the sort of thing that one should have. So I went through and I made John, I made my mom, and I made my dad. I set all of their contacts with the emergency contact option on there. What I did not know was that when we So I was the passenger in the car. I had my phone in my hand. I was looking at something. When we got hit, and we got hit on my side of the car, I took the brunt of it. My phone got knocked out of my hand. Also, my glasses off of my face, which I did not notice until I went back to the phone or back to the car to find my phone.
And my
glasses were right there, and I was like, "Oh, I'm not wearing my glasses." Fun fact: you don't notice that you're not wearing your glasses when you're like bleeding out of one arm. And like, I also didn't know I was bleeding out of one arm until John went, "Here's in your arm,"
because you couldn't see.
But no, I went to grab my phone out of the car, and as I was picking it up, my dad was calling me, and I answered it, and he went, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Okay, my dad knows." Okay. But I was like, yes, I'm fine. And then, like, after I got a phone with him, like, a minute later, because the cop was, like, arriving, I was like, I gotta go. My mom did the same thing and called me. So what I learned was that the impact of the crash, like, my phone detected it. I assume that it, like, checked on me first, or, like, I don't know, but it automatically called 911. And it sent a text to John, my dad, and my mom saying, like, crash detected with our location.
Huh.
So that's just my little PSA. Like I said, I don't know if this is universal on every phone, but go into your phone, see if it has this option to make someone your emergency contact, and set at least one person.
You figure with all, like, the stuff that Apple brags about their iPhones doing, that they would, like, you know, brag about that. And maybe they did.
Yeah.
Like, maybe there was a commercial for that, but I
typically tune them out because I already have an iPhone. Yeah. I don't need to be convinced to buy one. But seriously, like, you know, in this case, it wasn't... I mean, it was helpful that, you know, I didn't have to worry about trying to navigate my parents to where we were. It sent them our location, but, you know... In an instant when you could be in an accident in a more remote region by yourself, unable to call for help, you know, in any sort of different scenario, that could be the difference between life and death. You know, in this case, it wasn't. It was just merely convenient. But so, yeah, I highly recommend that. To go in and do that. My mom, like, literally, she told me the next day she went in and, like, was set, like, some emergency contacts on her phone. So, yeah. So, that's just a little update.
After that, I think you deserve some alcohol.
Yeah. And I will say, I'm going to do my best to get through this episode. But, Jason, at some point, if I'm certain to... Because my chest is where most of the pain has been... If I'm getting weary from talking, I might pass narration over to you.
Do you just want me to do the narration on this?
No, I would like to do it.
Okay.
Trying to get myself into more routine things.
All right.
But if I do find myself feeling it, I'll be like, I'll tag you in. I did that with my bad arm.
I was like, God, Harrison. Use your head.
I can't. that was actually a whole thing. My dad was like convinced, because there was like a crack on the windshield, that my dad was like convinced I had hit my head, and I was like, I'm like pulling back my hair, I'm like, I'm not bleeding, I have no redness, my head doesn't hurt, it's like the only thing that doesn't hurt. I was like, I didn't hit my fucking head. And finally it was my mom who pointed out that, because my elbow was all busted up and all that and all the cuts on my side, that I probably tried to shield my face with my arm, and that's what hit the windshield. Mm. So on that note, Jason, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking some red wine.
Yes.
Of the Franzia variety. Yes.
And I've got some Old Forester bourbon, in a little fancy glass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, my toast are to medical workers. I spent a couple hours in the ER that night, and we just had some amazing nurses and doctors who took care of me. Just super friendly, super fast. Yeah. All right, now that we've got that heaviness out of the way, Let's jump into some more heaviness.
Let's open up at a funeral home.
Yeah. So, in a funeral home, an old woman is her body has been prepared. The mortician and mortician's assistant, I don't know. They're like, oh yes, she looks great. She's ready for the visitation tomorrow.
I would have to guess the other person's probably a funeral director.
Maybe. It's
I would assume those are your two big cheeses.
Yeah, it's Nate and the other one from 6 Feet Under. I can't remember Michael C. Hall's character's name. The Fishers. But they leave, the lights are turned out, and another casket starts to open.
It's Buffy!
And then Xander out of a third, and then they have to help Dawn out of one that apparently has child locks. Quite frankly, all of the coffins in Sunnydale really should have interior locks.
It's like that episode of Family Guy where, you know, Quagmire fakes his death, and, you know, they bury him in the coffin, and then they start filling the grave with cement. They're like, what are you doing? Like, oh, well, Mayor West is afraid of zombies, so he's doing all that as a precaution. And so, like, no, wait, he's not dead. They open up the coffin, and, like, you know, Quagmire gets out. Mayor West is like, zombie!
You know, it's funny, there's a book that I have that I bought like in high school that's called How to Survive a Horror Movie, and it's like a parody book. It's very funny. Like one of the tips is if everything else fails, show your penis, because this is more true in like the aughts when I bought this book. But male nudity in horror movies is almost unheard of. So if you pull out your penis, you're no longer in a horror movie, and you're safe. Now, that is becoming less and less true. Ari Aster alone is like full dong in all my movies. But in the section on zombies, it was like, ironically, one of the safest places to be in a zombie outbreak is in a cemetery, because all the corpses reviving are stuck in boxes and buried under the ground.
I don't know, it sure as hell didn't feel safe at the beginning of Night of the Living Dead.
True. Also, Dawn is pissed because despite not being the shortest person in the room, she had to get in the smallest coffin. Buffy is really internalizing the fact that Dawn is gotten taller than her.
I love the random hostilities between the two in this episode. it's really funny because, like, you know, between all like the oh yeah, you're my sister, I care for you and everything. I do love when you get like the other side of being sisters. Like, she's my sister.
Yeah, it's very usually when there's conflict between the two of them, it's high drama. Like, it is the relationship they often have is like they're on good terms and everything's great, or there's high drama between the two of them. So it's nice to see this, like, they're not mad at each other, but they are doing little sisterly snipes.
Yeah,
that are like.
And I mean that just kind of like goes to show the good chemistry between Michelle Trachtenberg and Sarah Michelle Gellar too.
Absolutely. And I do think that sisterly relationship between the two of them is also highlighted nicely with both of their interactions with Cassie in this episode. There's a place where near the end where Cassie kind of touches Buffy's hair like Buffy always does to Dawn. I don't know if that was a deliberate, but that's a Buffy and Dawn thing is the hair. And so that when that happened, I was like, ooh. And there's another one that I want to save till we actually talk about it. But Buffy's stressed. She's already just has a stressful job as a slayer. There's this mysterious enemy that's everyone is foretelling. Man, she's nervous about starting her counselor job. Officially, she's officially the next day having her first day actually speaking with the students, and she's worried that she's not prepared to help these kids through the weirdness of high school. And Xander tells her, listen, no one is better prepared to help people through Sunnydale High than you. I agree. And then the old lady in the casket is a vampire, and they stake her.
Yep.
That takes us into the credits. And then from the credits, we do see Buffy. We kind of get a montage of her talking to different students. We have... should I get all their names correct? We have Peter, played by former Home Improvement star and current felon, Zachary Bryan.
So that was... Okay, yeah. All throughout the episode, I'm like, God, he looks like the older brother from Home Improvement.
Yep.
But I thought that, like... The times didn't work out right, but I guess, like, this had to have been while Home Improvement was going on, because he's definitely younger than his character was at the end of Home Improvement.
Home Improvement ran from 91 to 99, actually.
No, I mean, it was an incredibly popular show. Yeah. I mean,
I watched it.
Yeah, I did too, and I'm fairly certain he got, like, a lot of Emmy noms as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
I remember liking it. It was one of those ones that I would like my dad, my stepmom, and I would watch. So it was just like, I was a big fan of, is it Wilson? The neighbor
yes.
whose face you never see? That was always my favorite part.
No, like, yeah, I think my favorite part of that whole show is Wilson giving Tim the philosophical advice. Mm-hmm. And then Tim trying to utilize it, but quoting it entirely incorrectly. And that, it didn't matter how many times they did it, just, it's really good. And Tim Allen, I mean, this is like his time.
Oh, yeah.
Between like this and the Santa Claus movies mm-hmm. and like...
Toy Story
and like... Like, his popularity created, like, a bevy of movies like Jungle to Jungle and, what's another one that he, it's like Jungle to Jungle is the one Shaggy Dog remake.
Oh, yeah. Well, and of course, the epitome of his career, in my opinion, Galaxy Quest.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, the last we say about modern day Tim Allen.
What's been going on with modern day Tim Allen?
Oh, he's just like
yeah, the last, honestly, the last I heard of him was he was in that show Last Man Standing, mm-hmm. which was decently popular.
Yeah, I felt like it was popular amongst a certain demographic of men.
Alrighty.
I don't know. I've never seen it. I am casting aspersions without actually... Peter, however, he is concerned about...
Stuff.
Divorce, maybe. Girls, maybe. Turns out he really just doesn't want to be in class. We also get Tomas, who... angrily insists that he does not want to talk to Buffy, but over the course of this montage, he does open up, and we learn that his brother is going into the Marines, and he's really scared about that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Hang on, I feel like we need to give some. Clear the air about Tim Allen here, because I'm assuming you're like referring to his like political views.
Yes.
So Allen is a supporter of the Republican Party, describing himself as fiscally conservative and emotionally liberal. In 2021, he condemned then President Donald Trump and those taking part in the 2021 United States Capitol attack, calling the incident horrible, embarrassing, and shameful, and opining that the rioters must have had inside help. He also said the riot has caused people to be embarrassed to be known as conservative.
Okay.
All right. He is known for his philanthropic efforts to reduce homelessness.
All right. So, you know what?
I think we need to cast aspersions aside for that. I didn't mean to. I feel like we should like make sure that the air is clear on it.
We also meet Josh, a student who believes that he might be gay, but maybe Buffy should go on a date with him just to test. And we meet Amanda, played by Freaks. I think she's from Freaks and Geeks.
Yes. She plays Lindsay's former best friend before Lindsay, played by why am I blanking?
Is that Linda Cardellini?
Yes, okay. Thank you. Lindsay, played by Linda Cardellini. It was her before the events of the series. Her character is a very kind of like goody two shoes sort of thing, and her friend, played by this actress
Sarah Hagen,
was her best friend and also like goody two shoes. However, after a close relative dies, Linda Cardellini then becomes like disconnected with that sort of life and gets closer to the freaks of titular freaks of the show.
Well, Amanda is initially unsure of why she's been sent to talk to Buffy. She does open up that
she buries the lead.
She really does. She eventually does open up that a boy has been picking on her. Buffy gives her the advice, you got to stand up to a bully. And Amanda tells her, "Oh, I did. I jumped him in the parking lot and shoved stupid face into the basement."
Yeah.
I also do love, Buffy mentions in this conversation with Amanda that, a lot of bullies are just insecure. And while Buffy is right, I think Amanda's also right to push back on that a little and be like, yeah, that's what everyone says. I'm really sick and tired of everyone else being so insecure.
Yeah.
Like, it may be true, but that doesn't make it okay.
Yeah, and that kind of goes hand in hand with stuff like, oh, boys only tease girls because they like them and stuff. I'm like, oh, well, even if that's the case, they shouldn't freaking do that.
Yep.
And other such wisdom espoused by like our elders of the 2000s and 90s.
Yeah. So before we move on to the student who we're actually focusing on this week, Cassie, I just wanted to talk about this montage real quick because it's fun. Like, oh, I forgot. There is one final person other than Cassie. Someone whose sister really annoys her, doesn't let her make her own decisions, borrows her clothes without asking. Of course, it is Dawn.
I love that because it had to have just been you need to go to a counselor. Like, everybody's required to, like, have one session with the counselor or whatever. And I'm guessing that, Buffy's just the one on call for that day, and the fact that, Dawn gets there, I can just imagine them, the beginning of that, being like, okay, so what are we supposed to do about this?
See, I had a different kind of thought process of how we got here. I thought it was Dawn fucking with Buffy. I thought Dawn was just like, I'm gonna go to Buffy and just complain about all the things that annoy me about her in her official capacity.
And she can't do shit.
Of course, in real life, Dawn would never be allowed to see Buffy in a counselor capacity. But no, I just think this whole sequence it's funny. But it also, I think it does demonstrate that while Buffy is maybe a little nervous and a little hesitant about this job, she's got what it takes. Amanda, she talks her through everything and, eventually gets to the meat of the problem. With Peter and Josh, she picks up their bullshit pretty quickly and sends them back to class. With Tomas, she lets him sit and wait until he's ready to talk to her.
Yeah.
And then when they do talk, they have a really frank and honest conversation about, there's some... we don't dwell on this, but it seems like this household has some toxic masculinity. This kid feels scared to express his fears about his brother going into the Marines because it's not manly. It's a real tiny part of this episode, but I found it very
moving. Yeah, that was good writing, and also like probably I say this with zero knowledge of public schools, as I went to private schools from like kindergarten through high school, but it does seem like, you know, the range of stuff that you would get as a counselor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you know that now that I think about it, it doesn't necessarily have to be public school. This just happens to be a public school. I'm sure that you get that at like private schools as well.
Yeah. The kids who are coming in with serious problems and they need to talk through, and the kids who are trying to use this as an excuse to get out of class.
Yep.
And the counselor's little sister who wants to be a brat. We'll leave the school very briefly to check in with Willow and Xander. They're walking together, they're discussing Buffy's struggle with school and Willow's fears about the impending danger at the Hellmouth. She, continuing with her fears from last week, she's afraid that she came home too early, that she might lose control again. And Xander just gives her this lovely analogy about a hammer.
I do love when he like says, it's like, oh, it's like hammering a nail. And like Willow gives him this look, and I immediately wanted to jump into my, wait a minute, let's hear what he has to say.
Yeah. Which is what Xander said. He goes, yeah. I know his analogy. I mean, and this is what, so this is what we all do in real life, which is why it's such good writing. It's, you know, it's, we take something that we know, and for Xander, it's construction, and use those terms to help illustrate a point to your friend. He explains, you know, if he's hammering in a nail, holding at the very end of the hammer, he's got a lot of power, but very little control. But if he holds the nail up to the hammer all the way up to the head, he's got a lot of control, but very little power.
It's all about balance.
It's all about the balance.
I mean, it was kind of like fairly similar to what Giles was telling her. Yeah.
Across
the pond.
It's a lovely metaphor, and Willow acknowledges that. And then she's like, but I'm a little less worried about hitting my fingers with a hammer and more about enchanting the hammer to crack my friend's skulls open like a coconut. And I was like,
It's funny because it's a legit concern that she should have.
Oh, ooh, don't make me laugh.
Sorry. No, it's fine. I mean, this is the girl who enchanted like a bag of knives.
Bag of
so,
knives.
Yeah. I can't believe like I'm holding on to that so much more than I did my like previous watch through.
I love it.
Bag of tricks, bag of knives.
Willow and Xander do arrive at their destination, which is the cemetery, and specifically Tara's grave. So I did not realize this until I was putting the intro together, that Tara's birth date is listed on the headstone as October 16th, and this episode aired on October 15th. So if we're to assume that this episode is meant to be taking place roughly at the same time the episode aired, which Buffy tends to do, it's presumably Tara's birthday, which is why they're visiting. Mm-hmm. And it, based on the dialogue between the two of them, it is the first time that Willow has visited Tara's grave.
I miss Tara.
I do too.
Yeah.
This was... We don't see the scene, and I mean, weirdly, I'm glad it feels like it needs to be a private moment between Tara and Willow, and I don't want to intrude on it. Although I do feel sad that we don't get to see Allison Hannigan do some acting. But no, Willow puts some rocks on the headstone, which is a Jewish tradition, and she just says, "It's me," and it's
I think this was just enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If they had this conversation, it would kind of feel like something that, like, no matter how well you write it or how well Allison Hannigan would have acted it, it would have felt like something that was implied already.
Yeah.
That you didn't need to actually see. And the fact that there's so much other emotional stuff happening in this episode... Mm-hmm. it would honestly kind of just weigh this episode down emotionally.
Yeah, and it's already heavy.
Yeah.
So, speaking of which, this is when Buffy meets a student named Cassie Newton.
Who's a big fan of the White Stripes.
She is.
After she has two White Stripes shirts. And hey, I'll listen to Seven Nation Army anytime it comes on the radio. That's a bomb-ass song.
Yeah. I do want to just note this little bit of naming. Cassie, presumably a short for Cassandra, who was a mythological
seer
who was blessed with extremely accurate visions of the future, but cursed to not be believed when she tried to warn people. And then, after her visions came true, was blamed for them.
Because she was a woman.
Yeah. So, in many ways, this episode sort of upends that. You know, everyone does express a little bit of doubt initially, but Buffy is... once Buffy believes that Cassie has actually seen something, she is on her side the whole time.
Yeah. Well, I think it... And I think one of the reasons is because... Cassie says that, oh, I just know that things are going to happen, but I can't explain it. Mm-hmm. That probably makes Buffy err on the side of like, oh...
The supernatural.
Yeah, there's some supernatural tie to this. So that's why she kind of like immediately believes her and tries to like figure... Basically uses all of her experience that she's done before of like all the things that they've had to do involving people with random abilities. And I think that's kind of why that's only one more contributor to how Buffy feels like she failed her at the end of the episode. It's like, but you know, this is something that we probably dealt with something similar to it before. I just couldn't, in like all my experience, and I couldn't do anything.
Yeah. There's no monster for Buffy to fight here. You know,
there's
a literal
monster,
but it's unrelated.
Yeah.
Buffy, Cassie has been struggling with her grades. Apparently she's been pretty apathetic in class. So Buffy starts by saying, you know, we need your grades to improve so you can go to college, you know, all these things you could do in the future. And Cassie explains like, no, she's not going to do any of that because she's going to die next Friday.
And Buffy does jump to the first logical explanation for when somebody tells you that and assumes that, like, oh, you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to commit suicide, but Cassie does say multiple times that she's not going to do that.
And that is, it's the thing throughout the episode that we see that makes my heart break for her so much, is how badly Cassie wants to be wrong, but knows that she's not.
Well... You do get the little reference that she's reading Slaughterhouse-Five.
Uh-huh. Excellent little...
Yeah.
I had not read Slaughterhouse-Five the first time I saw this episode, but I read it very shortly after. I watched Buffy for the first time the summer after my senior year, and I read Slaughterhouse-Five that same summer. So I didn't get the reference the first time, but the second time I watched through, I was like... because that's all about like just the inevitability of
for those who are unfamiliar, first of all,
great book,
yes, written by Kurt Vonnegut. It talks about the main focus of the story is a man named Billy Pilgrim, who is a survivor of the Dresden bombing in World War II. And suffers from PTSD of that. However, he also has become unstuck from time. And
happens to the best of us.
And he sees his... he sees many things. He encounters aliens called the Tralfamadorians that are, like, hands with eyes in them.
Yep.
He also, like, finds out about his death. And all of this is... And he views it all at first with shock and horror. But because he has this knowledge, he sees the inevitability of some things. And so his signature phrase is, and so it goes. Mm-hmm. So it's very it's the most famous book by Kurt Vonnegut by far.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm actually a couple years ago, Kurt Vonnegut is actually from Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And in Indianapolis, a place that I found completely by accident when I was going to something unrelated. I was actually going to see Neil Gaiman at Butler University. And I remember I was like driving through getting to where I was heading. And I remember like I was at a stoplight and I saw this building that had a sign that said the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. And I was like, what? And so I kind of kept that in my head. And when I got to the Neil Gaiman event, I like looked that up and found out it's a whole museum dedicated to the works of Kurt Vonnegut. And it's a really cool place to visit if you're ever in Indianapolis. Yeah. It takes like maybe like an hour or two. Ever since then I've been wanting to like go through and read all of his books, because the only ones that I've read are Slaughterhouse-Five, which I read in college. Mm-hmm. And I started this like basically just going his published works in the order of that, and his first novel is Player Piano.
Okay.
Which Kurt Vonnegut is like a very prolific science fiction writer. Mm-hmm. If you didn't get that from the hand aliens. And Player Piano talks specifically about the dangers of automation in society.
Oh, something that's very relevant.
Other of his famous works include Breakfast of Champions, mm-hmm, and The Sirens of Titan, and he very much is known for his weaving of supposedly strange science fiction stuff into incredibly topical things, which honestly the best science fiction usually, mm-hmm, is.
Absolutely.
I recommend the works of Kurt Vonnegut.
I have only read Slaughterhouse-Five, and in fact the edition that Cassie is reading is the same edition that I have, that like brown.
Yeah.
And then we have a copy of Breakfast of Champions that I believe was John's mom's, but I've not read it. So
I actually did. I actually bought two things from the gift shop. There's one that is. One of the things that I bought was a t-shirt with the Tralfalmadorians on the front. Mm-hmm. And it said, like, Tralfalmador World Tour. And on the back, it has all of Kurt Vonnegut's novels listed in order of release.
Nice.
And the year that they came out. And that's the tour. And the other thing that I have is a coffee mug that has the cover, one of the covers of Breakfast of Champions on it.
I think I've seen that mug before at your house.
I do enjoy it.
So,
because coffee does help me get into that champion mindset in the morning.
Buffy has a lot of questions for Cassie, obviously, but Cassie doesn't really have answers for it. She says she doesn't understand. She just knows that she's going to die, and she knows that there's going to be a lot of coins. She also, as she's leaving, she compliments Buffy's shirt. And suggests that she puts a sweater on so it doesn't get stained.
She also says that she's going to try to help, and she's going to be somewhere dark and underground,
mm-hmm,
which we'll hang on to that for a little bit.
Buffy reports this to Principal Wood,
I just love seeing that man on the screen.
And she's like, what am I supposed to do? And he's like, you have already done what you're supposed to do, which is tell me. Buffy in this role would be a mandatory reporter. In my job, I am a mandatory reporter, because I also work with kids. My role in my job does not often have me working directly with the children.
You would still be obligated to.
Yeah.
Report it, which honestly, you should be anyway.
Well, and I did have to do that once. We had a kid who she was a very small child, and the comments she was making were she got saying something about, like, mom's bruises.
Ooh, okay, yeah, that's...
And it was like... But that was it, and it was hard to really understand what she was saying. She could have been saying something completely different, and I couldn't really tell. But I was like, you know, I need to err on the side of of caution
always.
Here.
Right.
And you know, I let the director of the education department know, and they took it from there. And I think ultimately it was nothing. It was a child saying random things because they're children.
Yeah.
But it's important to listen to what children are saying.
Yeah,
because they often can't really communicate what they need to.
Yeah, and, you know, it's also sad that in this case, you know, Principal Wood, I mean, he wants to help,
yeah.
But, like, he says it's the same old, like, song and dance whenever mm-hmm. they do this, and it kind of, like, almost lower, like, he just takes away the severity of
it. He kind of dismisses it as teen angst.
Which, again... I feel like, you know, when we say, like, he just dismisses it, it sounds bad, but at the same time, mm-hmm. you can tell that he, and I'm sure lots of people who work in public education and, like, education in general, I don't know why I'm always specifying public, I apologize, it just seems like that would happen with a lot more mm-hmm. frequency based on what some of my friends who are teachers have talked about.
Yeah.
But yeah, like... Anybody who deals with teenagers would come across this so many times that they'd be almost numb to it.
Yeah, you can... I mean, she's insistent that she's not suicidal. She's just obsessed with the idea of dying from his perspective.
At a particular time.
Yeah, you know, it's not right to be dismissive of it, but I do understand that you would just... I was a teenager obsessed with death, too. Teenagers, I think, do have a tendency to romanticize their angst.
But yeah. But as Buffy has not been in the in the dealing with teenagers that aren't Dawn department for too long. And let's be honest, Dawn's just 3 years old.
She's a toddler at this point.
Yeah. Which, I mean, in all honesty, are just short teenagers. Yeah. Or teenagers, tall toddlers.
As a former toddler and former teenager.
But, yeah, Buffy doesn't want to let it go. While this whole conversation is happening, Principal Wood does, like, pour some coffee for both her and him. And, like, he's trying to, like, you know, just be like, look, we're doing, like, this is all that we can do for right now. And she's like, no, we need to do more. And she, like, you know, bumps into the desk. And the coffee gets all over her shirt, and she's like,
her Slayer senses start tingling.
Yeah.
So we get. I just really like how this scene. It plays like a horror movie, but a comedic beat where we have Dawn a long walk from Dawn to her locker. She opens it. She's getting stuff out. She closes it. Buffy's there! Yeah. And then Buffy's like, I've got a job for you. And you know, you just know, Buffy was waiting at the end of the hallway, waited till Dawn opened the locker, and then she's like, get over there.
Yeah, that seems like something that, you know, the scene that we saw would be scary, would be Scream.
Yeah.
The scene of Buffy, like, waiting and then running up, it would be in Scary Movie.
Yes. I love thinking about that. So, like, Halloween movies. Michael is super theatrical.
Yeah.
But, like, it's always, like, the preparation is always off screen, and it feels very, like, out of character in some ways, even though it's stuff he's done from the first movie. I'm thinking of, like, when he puts Bob's ghost costume on.
Oh, yeah.
Or no, it's not Bob's ghost costume. He creates the costume. He just puts Bob's glasses over it. So at some point, Michael Myers is cutting out eye holes in a sheet. Like, he steals the gravestone. He's like, meticulously putting Linda's body in there. Like, that's Annie's bodies. And he does this over the course of the whole series. At one point, he, like, puts a flashlight in someone's head and puts that in a fish tank. But anytime he's on screen, he's like so straight-laced. Yeah. Like he's doing shit that feels more like Freddy Krueger.
He's a drama
but
queen.
But all off-screen.
He is all about the drama.
Oh my gosh, I love it so much.
Only slightly related to that, but comedian Pete Holmes, he does these really funny like Batman parodies where he's like a... he plays, the Christian Bale's Batman, mm-hmm. but if he was, like, kind of clueless and a bit of a dick. and they did, like, an episode where they, and one of his, like, original things was, Batman talking to Commissioner Gordon, and typically when Commissioner Gordon looks away and he turns back, then Batman's gone, and this one, like, Commissioner Gordon turns back, like, really quickly, and you see him, like, creeping away, like, Scooby-Doo style.
Yeah.
He's like, wait, are you doing that thing where you're, like, just trying to creep away, and then I'll turn around today? No.
Oh, my gosh. So, here we meet Mike. Mike Helgenberg. He is, a friend of Cassie's, but he also clearly has a crush on him, or a crush on her, that I think Cassie at least reciprocates,
yeah.
or would consider reciprocating.
Yeah.
Under different circumstances. He asks her to the winter formal.
It seems that the only reason that she doesn't want to go is because, you know, she could be dead.
And... she rejects him kindly, and he takes it well. He's still bugging her about it. This is, like, apparently not the first time he's asked, which I'm like, buddy, she said no. This does seem to be their dynamic.
Yeah,
and she seems
okay with
it. Yeah, I think
this is part of the
it.
Dynamic. Like, and it seems maybe, like, a little pestering from an outside mm-hmm. observation, but the way that they... that they interact, it feels like, oh, this could be like a, Cassie's like, just kind of doing weird stuff. Yeah. And
I got the impression, based on their interactions, that if she had said no and stopped fucking asking, he would have.
Yeah.
So she seems okay with this, so...
By the way, Dawn is like... eavesdropping like a fiend.
Dawn's just happy to be included. She's like, ooh, I have an assignment.
And she and she gets like really excited about like collaring a perp. But she does eventually like kind of interject and say, oh, hey, you're in my ceramics class, right? Like, ceramics class? Like,
sure.
Did we have an assignment? Like, oh yeah, we did have an assignment, but
glazes.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, I guess if you're going to do an assignment in ceramics class, glaze is going to be involved.
Mike does... he kind of takes this as a hint to go and finish
like, don't
studying
worry, I'm
elsewhere.
I'm going to go ace my history test.
Cassie's like, you're going to get a B.
Which, okay. He said that his test was about ancient Egypt, right?
Yes.
Then why was he emphasizing that he was holding a history book that said the land of the free... Which makes me think it's an American history book.
I'm gonna need you to take that up with the props department.
I'm sorry. I don't like attacking people of the industry. But that just like kind of hit me. Like, but wait a minute, that was an American history book. Maybe he should be happy that he got a B and not a D.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, where's the Declaration of Independence? What the hell is a pyramid?
This is a geometry. But yeah, Willow and Cassie strike up a conversation.
Dawn
and Cassie strike up a conversation. seem to get along.
Yeah.
Over at the Summers home, Willow is investigating Cassie on the computer. She suggests Googling Cassie. Xander says, Willow, she's 17. To which Xander says, Willow explains that it's a search engine. Okay. Let's age ourselves, because damn. Did you know that this... So Google was around, but was still relatively new I'm going to get an exact launch date for Google. Google was launched in September of 1998.
Okay.
So it's 4 years old at this point. This episode of Buffy was the first time the word Google was ever used as a verb on television.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Unless I've been lied to. Wow.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
So before I ever use Google,
this is according to an article by The Atlantic. So,
I don't know about you, but in grade school we had computer classes. I do remember once we moved on from the I think we always had Apple computers of all things, or Macintoshes.
Oh really? We always had the regular computer labs just had like PCs.
Yeah.
But the some of the art classes, art rooms, and like specifically ones that dealt with like graphic design and stuff, they definitely had Macs. We used Macs in the for the newspaper and yearbook when I did that.
So we definitely had iMacs. So the earliest computer classes that I remember are like the iMacs, like the green screens,
mm-hmm.
and we had floppy disks that were actually floppy disks.
Yes!
This is going to make me sound old as shit.
Floppy disks for the win?
But I do remember like it was a big thing when my grade school got like the next iMacs, which were the ones that were like in the really bright colors.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And we also like, that's around the time that we were in computer class, where we actually had to start doing assignments using word processors, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So this is when we got our own floppy disks that like are what you think of when you think of floppy disks now, like the save icon for mm-hmm. all those younger kids.
Yeah.
The save icons in all of your, in all your Word documents. Everybody had one where they would keep their classwork stored on. But I do remember our teacher was teaching us how to use search engines. And the two that I remember were Ask Jeeves.
Yes.
But since we were like fairly young, the big thing that we used was not Yahoo, but Yahoo designed for kids called Yahooligans.
Yes! Holy shit, I had forgotten Yahooligans. It had like games and shit.
It did,
and,
yes.
And it had like a built-in like safe search that like could not be turned off, which I think was its main feature.
Yeah.
But holy shit.
Yahooligans.
Yahooligans.
Uh-huh.
Oh my god. What a time to be 30.
Yeah. No, and it's like kind of, and it is kind of nuts because I didn't even think about the advances that were made in computers, and I kind of got to see all of that mm-hmm. as it happened. You know, I mean, obviously the punch card programming like predates me and stuff, but I didn't even think about it until I saw the Michael Fassbender Steve Jobs movie.
Okay,
and. I don't know. Have you seen it?
No, but I've seen the Ashton Kutcher one.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. I haven't seen that. But,
no, there's like... it's very interesting because I think a friend of the podcast, Ben Gerhardt, pointed out that it more seems like a play in three acts.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's three sections of the movie and each one deals with the personal stuff that Steve Jobs is going through before a certain product launches.
Okay.
And so it's three different launches. And each one is something that I like recognize, but like, oh yeah, wow, I really kind of saw the evolution specifically of Macs over like my time in grade school. So, and also that's a fairly good movie, and I really like the casting of Seth Rogen as Steve Wozniak.
Oh yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Who does Kate Winslet play in that movie?
I don't remember. It's been a bit, but all I can say is that I think maybe a business partner.
Because I remember...
could be his wife.
I remember seeing people say that should have been her Oscar movie and not The Reader. Which I've not seen Steve Jobs, but I remember like the like that that specific performance of hers getting like such positive reviews.
But yeah, I very much recommend it.
Yeah, I do want to watch it.
Yeah, I have it on Blu-ray. I'll try to remember to lend it to
you. Cool, thank you.
Yeah, hang on one second. Joanna Hoffman. Okay, so yeah, she's a marketing executive for Apple and Next.
Okay, cool.
And she's also like a confidant for Steve Jobs in the film.
Yes.
I might rewatch it before I lend it to you, though.
Fair enough. So, Willow does Google Cassie. They find that she has her own website, which is such an early 2000s teenager website. It's creepy drawings, morbid poetry.
It's like somehow Cassie got a hold of MySpace before it was a
right.
thing.
Willow explains, you know, this is what teenagers do. I used to post sad poems and the odd Doogie Howser fan fiction. Little would she know she would work with Doogie Howser in a few years.
So it makes me laugh that she said that, because the minute that she said that, both Buffy in the show and I in real life were like,
yeah,
trying to have the confused look.
I also like that when she's like, I made love poems, Xander's like, love poems, you say? And she's like, I'm over you, sweetie.
Yeah, get over it, Xander.
I love that they can kind of have this like teasy little relationship about that.
Yeah, remember...
I hate it.
Remember they were like kind of going through all that?
La 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 la, no I don't.
And poor Cordelia got a piece of rebar through her chest.
What the fuck was I watching the other day where... Oh, I wish I could remember. I was watching something where a main character got a piece of rebar through the exact same spot. And I was like, that has to be... Like, that. There's not a world where that wasn't a deliberate, like...
I don't know if it's necessarily a deliberate reference to Buffy. I think that...
I guess
that... I honestly, when I think about it, I can easily see that happening. Like, I think I've seen it at least a few
times.
Enough.
That's a pretty easy injury to give a protagonist that will keep them, like, injured for an episode. Uh-huh. And then they can be recovered from by the time.
And also, like, you know, it's probably pretty easy to do, like, prosthetic-wise
as
well.
That's true. All right, fine. I take your point. I don't like it, but I take it.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to rain on your parade.
Dawn gets home, and she's like... She goes full cop. A-cap, Dawn. A-cap.
I friggin' love that Dawn has yet to figure out the full nature of what the Scoobies are doing. Right. It's like, Dawn, you're almost there, but this is why you get the small coffin.
Yeah. Here comes small coffin Dawn, accusing the finger in the perp. But she's pretty convinced that Mike is going to be the one. He upset with the rejection, will hurt Cassie. But Buffy and the others are more concerned about information that they've just learned about Dawn, Cassie's father, who has a history as a violent alcoholic. Buffy and Xander go visit Cassie's father to confront him with their suspicions, and are basically immediately put in their place, because while their hearts are in the right place, it's very inappropriate for them to be doing this. And he basically tells them, like, yeah, I've got a fucked up past, I did bad things, but I never have laid a hand on my daughter, I never will, I pay my child support, I only get to see her once a month. And we learn in this conversation that their weekend visit was the previous weekend, so Cassie won't even, according to the custody arrangement, be with her father. You knew this actor, yes?
Shout out to Glenn Morshower, who has been in actually quite a few things.
I was looking at his
filmography.
Shield,
but like, I think probably his most famous role was in... A show that D.B. Woodside was in. He played the Secret Service agent that D.B. Woodside's older brother, David Palmer, who became president in the first season. And for those of you, he's played by Dennis Haysbert, the voice of Allstate. You're in good hands, if you've seen any of those commercials.
Which you probably have, because they're everywhere.
Yes. But yes, he plays a Secret Service agent who kind of becomes like a confidant of the president. And 24, I will say this, not having finished the show, but I saw the first six seasons, and those first five seasons, fantastic television. Mm-hmm. It's like every season, like the first season's really good, and it's a really great format for a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It honestly like had a... I've said before on this podcast that I think the epitome of action films is Die Hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I got kind of a Die Hard-esque rush every time I saw 24. And the fact that, like, you know, they have it take place in real time is pretty dope. And always, yeah, like, you know, you've got an added... You've got, like, a built-in layer of suspense.
Yeah.
And then, like, the first season, which was pretty good, it just kept getting better and better from there. And the fifth season is, like... Damn. Like, I can't believe they pulled off what they pulled off.
It is funny. I was like, wow, 24 keeps coming up a lot. And I'm like, yeah, because 24 started, like...
2001.
Yeah, so it's airing around the same time. Yeah, we're going to be seeing actors from that show on this show.
Yeah.
I only took, like, a brief glance at his filmography. The role that I recognized... It was just because it was a more recent watch for me. Was he played General Sam Lane on Supergirl?
Yep.
And he does not play that character on Superman and Lois. It's a different actor. But he was great in the scene. It's one scene, but I thought he was so good.
So I have a bit of a problem with this scene. And it's like kind of... And it's not anything to do with his performance. But at this point, it's like... The plot of the episode is very much in danger of just becoming a parade of red herrings.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, is this going to be the reason? Nope. Is this going to be the reason? Nope. And it kind of like... I'm not going to definitively say that I think it's... That's how it ends up looking. I think I overall like the episode. Mm-hmm. But there are moments like this that... And also, like, kind of the final, like, ritual in the library, mm-hmm, that really just kind of like, okay, so it's not this. It's not this. I'm like, all right.
So that's interesting you say that. I don't feel that way about this scene, but I do feel about that in the library scene.
And then, like, the crossbow scene, too. It's like, oh, it's not this either.
But I think that's by design.
It is definitely... The like, they didn't do that unintentionally, mm-hmm, but it also just kind of doesn't work for me.
Yeah. I think it works for me here, and it works for me, like, the only time it doesn't work for me is the cult thing.
Yeah.
Because it's the mundanity of what the actual thing is makes me, like, I don't know how to describe it, but it just works for me.
We mentioned this after we finished watching the episode, but, like, the subject matter and, like, kind of how deep it goes into it feels a little more at home on Angel,
mm-hmm,
especially, like, all the investigation as well. So, well, it's a little weird to see this sort of story progress the way that it does on Buffy.
Well, the theme of the episode, which is essentially boiled down to, like... You may not be able to save everyone, but you have to try.
Yeah.
That's, we've discussed many times, that's the theme of Angel. You have to keep fighting no matter what the outcome,
mm-hmm,
is. It was so funny when you said that. It's like, this felt like an Angel episode. I was like, I was thinking the same fucking theme with, They leave the house. Cassie is there for some reason. I guess she maybe... She's got psychic powers. I guess she was like, oh, I'm going to go see my dad. I got to go...
This is where she's wearing her second white striped shirt.
Yes, and I only noticed it because you had pointed out that the first one was a white striped shirt.
Well,
The second one had the band's name.
Yeah, I am... Harrison will tell you, I am a huge fan of graphic tees.
Yes.
And
you're currently wearing one that says "I Survived Helm's Deep," which I presume is in honor of oh gosh, I'm now forgetting the actor's name.
Bernard Hill.
Yes, Bernard Hill, who passed away yesterday.
He may have passed away yesterday, but I think the news came out today. Mm-hmm. But actually, no, I just...
Oh.
This is just in my shirt rotation.
Oh, okay.
And there is like a little white mark to kind of symbolize this, the paint mm-hmm. that Saruman puts on the face of his... On the face of his Uruk-hai.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I'm a big fan of graphic tees, and I just... That first one that had, like, the animation of Jack White and, oh, God, no, I can't just say Jack White's sister.
No, you can't, because that's misogyny.
I would feel like absolute shit if I said that. I gotta be honest, like, I don't know too much about the White Stripes. I kind of just know Seven Nation Army. Meg White.
Okay.
Yes. But, yeah. I mean, if you've heard, like, the song Seven Nation Army, it's pretty damn dope. It's the one that goes, do, 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 do.
Yes. I was like, you know you can't tell me the name of the song.
That's why I proceeded. That's yes, why I proceeded to do that. Oh, no, excuse me. She's not a sister. She was married to Jack White, and they got divorced.
Well, I'm glad they weren't siblings. What is this, Westeros?
Okay, so sorry about that. Like, sorry to all you White Stripes fans who are pulling your hair during these last couple minutes. But it's Meg White. Yeah, and it was like that first shirt was like animated drawings of like cartoons of Jack and Meg White.
So. They run into Cassie outside. Cassie explains that she appreciates that Buffy's effort to help her, but it's not going to do any good. And after some kind of prodding from them, Cassie has a breakdown, a subdued one, but a breakdown nonetheless, that reminded me so much of Buffy's speech to her mom in Becoming.
Yeah.
She breaks down about
how... I wish I could do all of this.
Yes. I want to go to the dance. I want to go to college. I want to fall in love. And all I could think of was that, like...
And you mentioned before, earlier in this episode, in this podcast episode, that, you know, you get the impression that, you know, Cassie is accepting of that she's going to die, but she also... does show that she wants to live. Mm-hmm. And if you got that impression, this makes it very clear.
Yeah.
This is the subtext becoming text.
Yeah, but she's resigned herself
yeah,
to
and
it.
Yeah, and it's a really good scene. The actress that plays Cassie does an incredibly good job.
Yes, so actually, I'm glad you said that, because I wanted to give her a shout-out. Her name is Azura Sky. I remember just being so impressed with her. She's been in a lot of minor roles and things. I remember she popped up in a very memorable episode, two episodes, I think, of American Horror Story in its first season, the Halloween two-parter. She plays one of the people who breaks into the murder house, and I remember her doing a great job there. But more recently, she was in a movie, came out in 2020, I think,
I figured she'd be in an episode of Smallville. She is.
Of course. So this movie is called The Swerve. So it came out in 2018. It was a horror drama film. I'm just going to read the synopsis here. It delves into the complexities of mental illness through the life of Holly, played by Azura Sky. As a high school teacher in a quiet town, Holly grapples with personal challenges, including a strained marriage and haunting memories. And sort of the inciting incident of this film is the titular swerve, in which she is involved in a hit and run. She is the hit and runner. It's an excellent movie. It's a horror movie, but it's very much a slow burn character study horror movie that she is the anchor of. It's a stunning performance. And I remember watching it and going, I wish this actress was in more high-profile stuff. Like, she's worked consistently. If you look at her Wikipedia page,
yeah, she's done all the TV shows of the 2000s.
Yeah, so which is great, but this movie in particular, I just remember being like, wow. That at the end of it, I was actually similarly like, because it's a very bleak film, and I remember being like, whew.
She's got she was also apparently in Wrist Cutters, A Love Story, so...
Yeah, and I've seen that movie, and I don't remember what her role was in it.
It had to have been a minor role.
Yeah, most of the roles in that movie are minor roles. Yeah. It's very much
Nick
a road
Offerman trip. Is randomly in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
I really love, a thing about her is she's got this, look and this voice that's very distinctive.
Yes.
So, I don't know if maybe that hurts her in the getting the high profile stuff. I don't think it should. I really like her look and her voice.
Yeah.
So
she definitely, what she does here in this role so good is...
Are you referring to Cassie?
To Cassie, yeah, yes. Okay. Is I can see the teenage girl there who she plays it in this way that, especially in this scene where, yeah, she is interested in the quote unquote girly things. But she is, like Buffy, so weighed down by this one specific thing that she is stuck with.
Yeah.
Which is, a power she didn't ask for, and a death sentence. And unlike Buffy, Cassie knows exactly when her clock expires. Which is, I don't know if that's better or worse, but I can see the teenage girl struggling with the weight of all of this, and she just does it so well in this one episode.
I actually was recently thinking out of nowhere about that philosophical experiment. If you had the ability to for somebody to tell you the exact day that you were going to die, would you want to know? And I think maybe I was just thinking about Big Fish and seeing your death in the witch's eye, because that's not only that's more how you're going to die, not when. But you could probably tell by how old you are. But
that is the boys have different reactions, because one could tell that he was very young when he died, and Ewan McGregor and Albert Finney, what's their character's name?
Edward Bloom.
Edward. He sees that he's very old when he dies, and how that affects the rest of their lives is very apparent. I love that movie.
I'm thinking that you know I love that movie. That's... I'm not going to, pose that question to you, because I think it's something you want to think about, because there's, there's many reasons to... I think there's many good reasons in favor of and also against doing it. It's the day that you're going to die, then you kind of feel invincible and you can live your life free of that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. But there's also the off chance, and this is more of an indicator of what kind of person you are. It's if you know the exact date that you're going to die, are you just going to dread that date?
Yeah. And it's funny, because my actual answer to a lot of philosophical questions like these are, that's not possible for me to know the exact date I'm going to die, so I'm not going to worry about it.
Oh, you're not fun. You're no fun.
But no, I like the philosophical discussion of it about how that would affect your life. But then at the end of the day, I'm very able to just go, but that doesn't really matter, because
Wow, Harrison, way to take the whimsy out of dark philosophical issues. Ass.
We get a quick shot of some people in red cloaks walking in a circle, burning a picture of Cassie. Just, normal things that happen in Sunnydale.
It's not even an exaggeration. We've probably seen that happen at least 4 times, if not more.
Buffy, of course, is still determined to help Cassie. She goes down to the basement to see Spike. I like that they have brought back Spike's blue lighting. It's a nice visual touch. But Spike is kind of catatonic.
I'm not going to lie. At first I thought this was just like one of those scenes from season 4 where it's like, oh, we got to have Spike in here.
I mean, it kind of is, but it does have a payoff.
There's a bit of a decent payoff in it.
But she basically is like, is there anything evil in the school basement that might hurt this girl I'm trying to help? And he's like, first of all, like, yeah, of course there's evil
shit. There's evil shit everywhere.
But when he starts talking about hurting the girl, he starts hitting himself. He mentions voices. And Buffy has to clarify that she's not talking about him hurting her, but a girl named Cassie who is going to die on Friday. And she's basically like, okay, this is useless. Upstairs in the main school, Principal Wood is searching lockers, looking for anything suspicious. Buffy catches Mike and is basically like, huh, you asked Cassie out to the formal, I bet, didn't you? And she rejected you. Didn't that make you mad?
Now she's rolling a done suggestion.
Yeah.
Also, it is really funny because I kind of mentioned it before, but I love how, you know, when he meets Dawn in the library, it's like, Dawn Summers? Oh, wait a minute, you're the counselor's sister. It's like, she's my sister. And then when he's like, wait a minute. Oh yeah, you're Dawn's sister, and he's like, she's my sister.
Yep.
Very good.
God, they're so alike.
Yeah. I do love side note, but I love whenever Sarah Michelle Gellar or Michelle Trachtenberg post pictures of them like nowadays together, and
it's
they're
sweet.
Like, yeah, with my sister. I'm like, oh.
I'm gonna after we finish this, I'm gonna find a clip from like the Gossip Girl revival, which I never watched any iteration of Gossip Girl. That just passed me by completely. But I saw someone share this clip from a scene of Michelle Trachtenberg's character on the show that is so fucking unhinged. I want to show you because it's really funny.
All right.
I think. I don't even know what the context was, but I feel like that makes it even better. But Mike's like, oh yeah, she totally rejected me. It's like, whatever, I'm not hung up on it. I was actually thinking about asking your sister. And Buffy is immediately like, oh, okay. And then she was like, wait, my sister was your second choice?
Yeah.
Actually, apparently his 106th choice, according to how many times he asked Cassie. But at this point, she is distracted by a bunch of coins falling from a locker.
Good job on the writer, Rebecca, putting being able to fit in like a couple really funny things, particularly between Buffy and Dawn in such a heavy episode.
Yeah, it's not a funny episode by any means, but like there's enough lighthearted stuff in here that just like allows you to take a breath, and then we can get back into it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this is a complaint sometimes that people have of Joss Whedon's work, of sometimes relying too much on humor. And I do think that's sometimes an accurate criticism. I think especially some of his later stuff, when that became kind of a staple of it. I think Age of Ultron, in particular, is really bad about it. So many
quips.
But, like, here we're still in that era where it was well-balanced.
You know, and I'm pretty sure that we've mentioned before how there are sometimes where, like, a joke, like, does not land well, whether due to its subject matter or just its timing. So, you know, not everything lands, but I agree there is like a better, there's like a very decent balance, and it's honestly one of the things that gives Buffy its charm and character, and has allowed it to endure the way that it has, because, and I feel that, you know, even without directly referencing it, shows like that deal with supernatural things like Supernatural, or The Vampire Diaries, or honestly, like, anything that involves, like, any teen, like, teen high school action yeah. comedy, like, teen high school action show that more than likely is going to be on the WB/CW.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them owe that debt of gratitude mm-hmm. to the writing of this.
Yeah. I do think it also helps that, despite how much, how serious the show is and gets, and it also does have a base level of camp that it
yeah.
can fall back on when it needs to. But yeah, they a bunch of coins fall from one of the lockers, and Buffy talks to the student who the locker belongs to, and this student confesses that he and some of his friends they have plans for Cassie. So Don and Cassie are leaving the school. Cassie basically tells Don, like, I know that your sister sent you to pretend to be friends with me. And Don's like, yes, that is what happened, but I wasn't pretending. I was your friend. And Cassie's like, I know you were. And it's a really, it's a very sweet moment between the two of them that is unfortunately the last time they will see each other. Peter calls out for Dawn, and Cassie tells her everything that's about to happen, it's not your fault.
Mm-hmm.
And in the moment where Peter distracts Dawn, asks her if any, he's just a dick, he asks her if anyone has asked her to the dance, when she says, she like kind of gets a little flirty and is like, oh no, actually, and he was like, okay, I was just taking a poll, and laughs at her and walks off.
What an ass.
And she, yeah, she turns to Cassie to say what an ass, and Cassie is gone. This is not shown on screen, but we can put the pieces together that Peter, Cassie was grabbed while Peter distracted Dawn. This is where we get, for me, the weakest part of the episode. Peter and a bunch of other boys are in red cloaks. They are going to sacrifice Cassie yeah. for riches.
Yeah, this seems like so off the wall and so silly. And I think maybe one of the reasons why I like made that red herring thing mm-hmm. is like I don't have a problem with that scene with her dad. But this kind of makes it feel like it almost takes away from the seriousness of the episode.
Well, part of the issue that I have with it is everything else in the episode outside of the psychic visions is pretty relatively grounded, even for Buffy, or especially for Buffy, yeah. it's pretty grounded. But it's also just, quite frankly, a repeat of the episode Reptile Boy, where Buffy and Cordelia yeah. are going to be sacrificed by guys in red cloaks to a demon so that they yeah, can get rich.
It, yeah, like many things in season 7, it is meant to be a callback
yeah.
to that.
But I feel like this would have worked better, and I, the, you know, in here we're getting into a bit dicier, you know, areas of like violence against women, but I feel like this maybe would have worked better if it had been just Peter wanting to harm Cassie for fun, for, you know, I don't, that fits more with the tone of this episode.
Yeah, and this goes very much against kind of the tone of everything that we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think, or it's still a group of men, but without the demon aspect of it. I think that like this culty demon aspect of it just flies in the face of everything else in the episode. And you know, I don't want it to take a too exploitative place. You know, I don't necessarily think we need to go to a place of like sexual violence against her or anything like that, but I think something more grounded in human violence would have worked better here and fit the tone of the episode more, and still have that sort of red herring leading up to what is ultimately a fairly mundane death for Cassie, without this silliness.
Yeah. But yeah, like the fact that yeah,
they're quite literally red herrings.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the guys mentions that he's like set up something just to make sure that nobody gets into the library. We don't know what. Chekhov's smoking crossbow. Yeah, they pull out Cassie and they start performing the ritual, and these guys like clearly don't really know what they're doing except for what was his name?
Peter.
Listen,
I only know that because I got the wiki in front of me.
but it turns out that one of the people in the red cloaks is Buffy, which, how did you not notice that?
This was bothering me too, because the rest of them, all of their hoods clearly show their faces.
Yeah, their faces are exposed.
So, like, if they were all, like, really heavily hooded, then I'd allow it.
But, yeah, but whatever. Yeah. So...
Sorry, I'm just gonna read this. As Peter starts the ritual, Buffy suddenly rips off a cloak, unveiling herself to the group, and then smacks him around a bit.
It's true. It's funny. I made the little joke that, the brand of cleaver that, I've already forgotten his name.
Peter
is going to use on Cassie is Dexter brand, which made me think, and it's so funny because you brought up Michael C. Hall earlier.
Yeah, that's true. It's a real brand.
No, I believe it.
Because I was going to say, this is definitely too early for Dexter the TV show, yeah. But I don't know about the books.
Oh, the Darkly Dreaming Dexter?
Yeah. Still too early for that. Okay. That was 2004. So just barely.
Just a little fun coincidence.
Yeah.
So Buffy does beat him, like,
knock
beat
up
him
a
around.
Bunch of teenage boys.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Well, actually, I think she just beats up Peter.
A couple of the other ones try to...
Oh, that's true.
They get, like, kick and they're done.
But yeah, but Buffy thinks, like, oh, this is silly. You all are a bunch of idiots. You didn't think that you were actually going to summon a demon, were you? And Peter's like, oh, that demon. And the demon that they were trying to summon is there.
This Kmart version of Skip.
Sort of. Yeah.
I did not care for this demon.
Yeah, and then you have this fight scene, this protracted fight scene. It looks like Peter is going to get to sacrifice Cassie while Buffy's occupying it, like, thrown around herself by the demon. But then Spike shows up with a... like, flaming stick or something.
It's the one that Peter lights
earlier
in the scene.
That's like, right. He had a torch.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I meant to say. Not flaming stick. Oh, my God. But Buffy is able to use this to basically just, like, stab the demon with and set him on fire. And
immolate
and Spike,
him.
Yeah. Spike is able to, fight off Peter... Granted, with, like, harm to himself every time he punches Peter, he gets a shock from the chip, but he says, like, oh, he won't hurt the girl, and then he just, like, kind of bugs out. This fight scene is, I didn't like the ritual scene, not a big fan of the fight scene.
No.
And it's more just, like, because it's part of that ritual scene.
Yeah, and it feels like it's not particularly creative.
It's kind of just there.
It's kind of there. It feels drawn out, like we're padding the runtime a bit.
Yeah.
But they are able... Spike frees Cassie. Cassie tells him, someday she'll tell you. And he's like, okay, weird girl. I'm going to go back to the basement to talk to myself.
What a weirdo. Isn't that right? Random... person I've been talking to.
Peter is, like, crawling towards the demon going, where's my money? It's very stupid. I hated it. And the demon bites him, and he's like, oh, I got bit. And
help Buffy's me! Like, somebody bit me! Something bit me!
And Buffy's like, my office hours are 8 to 3 or whatever.
10 to 4.
10 to 4. Which I did like that line. I was like... But, they walk out the door. She's like, you're safe. They trip one of these traps. Crossbow shoots out. Buffy catches it, like, less than an inch from Cassie. And she's like, see, I've got you. You're going to do great things. And this is the moment where I mentioned earlier where Cassie kind of tucks Buffy's hair back. And she says, yes, you will. And then she collapses and she dies. We learn in the coda of the episode that Buffy found out from Cassie's mother that they have a family history of heart irregularities, which Cassie didn't know about.
Otherwise, with the whole, like, oh, I'm going to die then, and I don't know why, that probably would have been, like,
I mean,
oh, okay.
Could have been avoided. I mean, entirely, I mean, literally, I would imagine the whole ordeal and the stress leading up to this, knowing she was going to die, almost like, in many ways, could have been a self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, she had all this stress on her, and then this, you know, final night really triggered all of that. And if she had known about this heart irregularity, possibly could have avoided all of this. Or not, you know. But Buffy's beating herself up. She's saying, you know, this is my fault. I failed her. And probably in one of Michelle Trachtenberg's best performances across the series, and she's given a lot of really good ones, you know, she's devastated, but she tells Buffy, no, it's not your fault. You did everything you could to save her. And she was my friend, and I wouldn't have been her friend if it weren't for you. And, you know, and that leaves Buffy with this feeling of, like, you know, what can I do if I can't help everyone? And we end the episode with Buffy going and sitting at her desk with that on her mind.
Yeah.
And it's heavy. It's heavy, and it's really
yeah, it's also, like, kind of a bit more of a heavier theme than we're used to in, especially, like, when you look back at the earlier episodes of Buffy.
Yeah.
Like, this really, I was telling my friend last night, I was in Lexington, and she was telling me about how, like, she was kind of, like, watching Buffy, but not really watching it, just kind of, like, playing it in the background.
Mm-hmm.
She does want to, like, go back and actually, like, legit sit down and watch it.
Yeah.
But she was, like, talking about Innocence, and how it's, like, God, man, that's, like, nuts how that, like, you know, what, she has sex with Angel, and he loses his soul because he has, like, a moment of pure joy or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, that's honestly probably the moment where the show, like, basically all the preconceived notions of, like, oh, this is just, like, some kids in high school fighting monsters kind of broke open.
Yeah.
And I feel that Buffy's, like, getting progressively working more adult themes into that, probably, like, the biggest one being, like, the death of Joyce.
Yeah.
And dealing with that. But yeah, this is pretty rough too.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm glad you brought up the death of Joyce, because this episode is the second and final episode of the series that features a character dying of natural causes.
Mm-hmm.
Cassie and Joyce are the only two characters who die from natural causes in both shows, Angel and Buffy. Yeah. Also, Anya's not in this episode.
She's not.
Which, I get it. I don't see where Anya could be placed in this episode.
Yeah, this very much needed to be, like, centered on Buffy and Dawn and Cassie.
Yeah.
And
Willow and Xander are there providing support, but yeah.
And so is Spike.
Yeah.
In a smaller sense. But yeah, this is a good episode.
It is a good episode.
Yeah, yeah. It's I mean, you know, we're both suckers for emotionally traumatic episodes. I think I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5.
Yeah.
Four burning sticks out of 5.
I'm also giving it a 4. I'm going to give it 4 blue clam cults out of 5.
Oh, Lord. It's like, we can't say Blue Oyster Cult.
I thought the joke was just she doesn't know the name of the band.
Oh, okay. It probably is.
But I don't know. Buffy's generally pretty pop culture literate, but no. It's a strong episode. But yeah, I think it unfortunately loses some steam there with the cult stuff.
Yeah.
Which is the very end of the episode.
Yeah,
which
it comes across more as silly than anything else.
Yeah.
And it's like, we were talking about how there's good humor in this, and then there's this, like,
strange camp that just doesn't belong.
Luckily, the final scene, as short as it is, is strong enough to salvage all that. It's so, you know, I'm not going to hold one misstep against a whole otherwise really strong episode other than just say I wish it had gone a different direction with that. Okay, well, Jason, take us out.
All right. Thank you for joining us on Booze and Buffy. We'll be back next week with Angel, Season 4, Episode 3, The House Always Wins.
A decidedly lighter affair.
We're going to Vegas, baby!
I'm Harrison. You can find me on Instagram at Harrison Alexander Kaufman and on Twitter at Harrison Kaufman. That's C-O-F-F-M-A-N.
And I'm Jason. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at YamiJ357.
And you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Booze and Buffy. Or you can email us at boozeandbuffy@gmail.com. The and is spelled out A-N-D.
And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. And, you know, just in light of my most recent time in the emergency room, just remember to treat healthcare workers with kindness and respect, especially the... lower paid ones like your nurses and who are doing a lot of work. I want to shout out to one particular nurse that I had who had also been in a car wreck less than a week before, who was taking care of me, and she was so kind and so gentle. And oh my god, I had to have a CT scan. Have you ever had a CT scan?
I don't think so.
So they basically they had to do like an IV to put some like dye in me, essentially, for the imaging. And it was taped on me all night, and so when she went to take the IV out, it was taped on my arm, and she was like, all right, I'm gonna pull it off all in one, it's gonna take some hair out. So based on her like wording, I thought she meant the tape. She meant that tape and that IV, and she got it all out in one. I didn't even realize it was out. No blood. I mean, like a little bit of blood, but like not like a geyser.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just, you know, healthcare workers are, especially in this sort of quasi post COVID world, be kind to them and support them when you can.
Yep.
All right. As always, go slay
and be gay.